staff, staff from the Science Center and the regional office. And it was just to start planning for the upcoming groundfish assessments and how we're going to do things and what data will be used and all that. That will take place in 08.
Starting in 07, right, Paul?
Right. We had a meeting last week with a delegation from the EU. There was half a dozen of them that were there. They were over here trying to see the public process and how it works. And they're trying to set things up over there. They thought New England fisheries were very aligned with what they do over there. So we had a pretty full day. They were in the area for a little while longer. It's interesting. They had a meeting the night before, and they were told how bad things are and they don't work. And it seemed to be it was the scallop fishery that was telling them that our way of managing doesn't work. We had chairman's meeting in Philadelphia a couple weeks ago. Most of the issues will be discussed under other topics or other headers today and tomorrow. There was a report on Magnuson Stevens reauthorization. There was the MRFs data, what to do with the report and how to use it in upcoming and how they're going to try and fix the assessments, or actually the entire MRF system. Standardized bycatch was talked about, and how New England and Mid-Atlantic are working on that. We also have that on the agenda. The budget, which is not much of a change. Councils continue to be underfunded. NEPA was a lot of time, how we'd like to see NEPA changed. There's an ICAP meeting in the fall. It was decided that somebody from the Gulf Council, it was either the Gulf or South Atlantic, might be South Atlantic, will be going as a two-week meeting in Croatia for ICAT. And the only bright spot, which we'll hopefully we'll hear a little bit more about, we heard some anecdotal information on dogfish, and Dr. Pierce should be smiling. It's only one data point, but it's one data point can always do a lot of bad things, but this one is... I think everybody can tell by Dr. Pierce's expression over there that it was good news on dogfish. So. You don't? Oh, you don't? Okay. Anyway. Well, we'll discuss that later. But I suppose the last survey, they found the dogfish. So you were worried. Okay, that's all I have. Are there any questions? Okay. With that, Paul?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you allow me, I'd like to go into a little more detail on the GARM and our meeting on the GARM. If everyone goes into tab 1, number 6, you'll see some discussion on the GARM timelines and issues with the GARM. And basically... Council staff, Science Center, NIMS folks, and some members of the executive committee met to talk about the timeline for the GARM and whether or not we should prepare for an EIS. You know, it looks like not only are we going to be looking at new reference points, perhaps, but we're also maybe looking at additional restrictions on some stocks. And we also, it's been 5 years since the EIS, believe it or not, 5 years since the EIS for Amendment 13. So there's a requirement that you shouldn't let EISs lapse 5 years or policy. And with our experience trying to do a framework with a short amount of time and also being steered, encouraged by Sally's letter about let's do some early planning. We've met twice now to figure out how we're going to deal with the GARM and the timing of the GARM. Well, we talked about basically there's three options. There's an option where we use 2007 data and we have the GARM late August and the report early September and make an adjustment. And the adjustment has to be submitted by January 1st to be implemented in May. Now, that's an awfully short time frame, does not give us the opportunity to do an EIS, and basically only gives us the opportunity to reduce days at sea. It's really not a lot of time. But the good thing about that option is you use 2007 data. Now, if you want to move that up into the late spring, early summer, and have the GARM, so it gives us a couple more months, and perhaps get the report in May, we could only use 2006 data. And, you know, what was it, 2005 or 4 when we just implemented Amendment 13. So it doesn't give us a lot of time if we only use 2006 data. But it does give us more time to develop management measures, but certainly not enough time to do an EIS. So the key is under option 1 and 2. Option 1, you use current data. Option 2, you use up to 2006, not 2007 data. And in either case, both cases, not enough time for an EIS, which most of us agree we might want to think about that. Might be a requirement. And then there's option 3, again, where we start a amendment immediately. Now, we start an amendment and hopefully have it done within a year and a half, which lays the ground rules for days at sea adjustments or quota adjustments. And then we do a framework like a spec package. Okay, that's the option. We do an EIS, programmatic, that basically says we're going to adjust by days at sea or we're going to adjust with quota or combinations, do it rather quickly, a year and a half, and then when we get the results from the GARM in August, we just do a spec package which with an EA. Now, all of these options have problems. If we're going to change direction, look at Amendment 13. It took us four and a half years to do amendment for groundfish. It's, can we really change direction midway, do an EIS, and, expect to get it done in a year and a half? I don't know. It seems highly unlikely. But the problem is there's not a lot of good options to get a lot of very important decisions on 19 different stocks with reference points, have to put in rebuilding plans because, as you know, we're going to have to rebuild from 2009 to 2014, 5 years to rebuild to sustainable levels. So we almost all unanimously said we better plan on an EIS to do rebuilding plans in 5 years for 19 different stocks or so. Not all of them will need rebuilding, but rebuilding plans, but it's pretty significant. Anyway, what we're going to do is staff's going to lay out a white paper over the next couple months and have a presentation about the different options, the pros and cons, and we'll put it on the agenda and have enough time on the agenda in September for the council to choose an option. How do you want to proceed with groundfish for 2007 and 8 in preparation for the implementing 2009 measures? Do you want option 1, 2, 3, or some other option? So I'll get that white paper out to you early so you have a couple months to look at it. And in September, when we meet next, we'll discuss how we're going to proceed with groundfish. Okay. Second thing I'd like to report is our budget's been level funded now for – we get back after and answer questions. Our budget's been level funded for the last several years, and we're down probably 30% from where we should be if you look at inflation and everything over the last 5 or 6 years that we've been level funded. And the binders, these binders here, have gone from, preparing 24 binders for council meetings to almost 80. And you can imagine the workload on the secretarial staff and the cost of preparing 80 binders. What we've been doing is giving them out to the public and giving 5 to NIMS and 6 to the Science Center and anyone in the public who wants a copy. So we've stopped that, and what we've done now is we've scanned all the binder material and or electronically put the binder material on the web page. So for the public, at least 10 days in advance, just like we get these out to you, the public can go on the web page or anyone and can download the information that would be in the binder. So that's that's new. And also, we will have three copies of the full binder on the table for each council meeting, and we'll also have select material like decision documents, framework documents, maybe 50 copies for the public. So we won't be changing that. People can still pick up material, but the benefit will be savings for council budget, and also the benefit will be to the public that they'll get the documents much earlier, having them on the web page. There'll be some savings associated with that, and we've gotten we've been using our advisory panels very prudently for the development of our management actions, especially scallops. And I brought to the executive committee that it's time to increase their meal allowance. The budget did not allow it, but with savings, I need $4,000 to pay them $30 a day instead of $15. So the executive committee agreed, let's pay advisors $30 a day for meals. So we'll do that. And lastly, again, I've got a personnel issue that I'd like to bring up with the staff, so we'll close a session of a particular portion of the meeting over the next 3 days to iron that out. I'd like to thank Bill Hogarth and probably Phil Rule as well, but as you recall, at the request of Phil and others, Rodney, we've sent a letter to Bill Hogarth asking for some funding to support our enforcement VMS and safety committee, and Bill has sent us funds for 6 meetings. So Lou will be getting in touch with Rodney and Phil to get an agenda and a planning document going for how we want to utilize those 6 meetings. So we can start planning on that. That was good. On Monday, I'm flying into Virginia. It appears that there's kind of a national meeting to look at wind farm energy. And I've been invited to attend. And basically, it appears that the wind farm industry is just about close enough to the next level technology to really make wind farms very economical and the way to go. And once they get to that point, they really want to start implementing wind technology. Not quite there yet, but once they get to that next level, which is soon, they want to start putting up wind farms in a more deliberate manner. So there's a national meeting in Virginia that I'm going to attend and talk about fishing interests, our habitat regulations, the kind of data we have with VMS that show the fishing grounds and traffic patterns and steaming lanes and fishing grounds, and talk about the importance of fishing to our communities, etc. So I'll be attending that meeting in Virginia on Monday and Tuesday. And lastly, we're having a cruise this evening in memory of Frank, who's departing as our council chairman. It's from 6:30 to 8, $20 per person, no reservation needed. Pick up the boat right across the street, the Viking Queen. 6:30 to 8 p.m., cash bar. There'll be some light appetizers, and hope you can all make it. 6:30 to 8, right across the dock, motor vessel Viking Queen. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? Dave?
Not so much a question, but some information to provide, and that is I'm glad to see that the staff will be preparing that white paper relative to the GOM3, the timelines and the issues, and to assist the staff in that regard, especially with reference to option 3, I provided staff with a document that I prepared back in 1982. Scary. Back in 82, that detailed the evolution, the development and evolution of the groundfish plan, with, of course, a heavy emphasis on a description of all of the doings that related to hard TAC management. Of course, there was a great deal of discussion about hard TAC management now, and therefore I suspect that this document will help people understand that, indeed, it is not, as described in Option 3, a way to simplify the management of the fishery. Take note of that language in Option 3. If we do go the way of hard TACs, it has its own unique set of very significant management problems that must be overcome in order to successfully implement a hard TAC program. I'm not saying I'm against it, because I'm involved with hard TAC management now, especially with the Mid-Atlantic Council. And of course, we have some hard TAC management here in New England, but we need to all refresh our memory as to what happened back in 1978, 1979, 1980, 1981, when there was nothing but chaos and heartache regarding the hard TAC management at that time, just for cod, haddock, and yellowtail, never mind the suite of groundfish species that we now have to manage. So, again, thanks for that effort on the part of the staff, that production of the white paper. That will definitely be useful.
Anybody else? Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, I guess, or a thought occurs to me while listening to the three options that we have outlined here. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind, whether you go to 2006 or 2007, if you use an 07 data, 42, the effects of 42 are going to be very hard to see. And so we need to really keep that in mind going forward. We got to just make an adjustment that we ain't going to have any benefit or negative. We're not going to notice whatever came out of it within that. So I don't know. I mean, I understand and appreciate the idea of the white paper going forward. We definitely need to be doing something. We also need to keep in mind that we've made changes, and we got to see what the benefits or the losses from them changes were. Thank you.
Paul?
That's exactly what our PDT always does is, you know, when we were doing our annual adjustments, they project from the measures that were just put in place, looking at landings over 3 or 4 months, they try to make projections, but it is tough with projections.
Anybody else for Paul?
Okay. Pat's not here. Would George report?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a relatively brief report. Framework Adjustment 18, final rule for Atlantic sea scallops, was published June 8th and will become effective June 15th. The closed area 2 yellowtail flounder SAP, we published on May 22nd a temporary rule in the Federal Register notifying the public that based on the RA's authority and the criteria in the regulations, no trips into the SAP will be allocated for the 2006 fishing year. On May 23rd, we sent a letter to Northeast Multispecies Days at Sea vessels, reminding them that Framework Adjustment 42 includes a proposed requirement that all Days at Sea vessels, groundfish Days at Sea vessels that intend to fish under a Northeast Multispecies Days at Sea must have an operational VMS on board the vessel. The proposed rule for Framework 42 is still under review and should be published sometime in the near future. A summary of Days at Sea leasing program from May 1, 2006 through June 8th. There have been 32 leases approved, total of 1,266.53 days at sea leased at an average cost of $333.85 per day at sea. On May 15th, we published a notice of intent announcing dates and locations of scoping meetings for Amendment 14 to the Groundfish FMP. That's the small mesh fishery amendment. And the public comment period closes on June 16th for that action. And yesterday, June 12th, we published a notice of affirmation of control date for the small mesh groundfish fishery as an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. Comments on that will be accepted through July 12th, and that control date is March 25th, 2003. The current status of groundfish catch in the U.S.-Canada area, as of June 7th, the estimated cumulative catches for the Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, based on the existing observer program data, which does lag significantly, was for cod, 18% of the tack, for haddock, 4% of the tack, and for yellowtail flounder, 14% of the tack. During the same period, our VMS reports, which are more current, come in more quickly than the audited observer reports, indicate that 31% of the cod tack has been harvested. So we expect that probably a minimum of 31% of the cod tack has been harvested at this point, although we can't put an exact number on it, and we have anecdotal information that indicates that there are some large discards of cod occurring. As of May 24th, a total of 132 trips have been taken into the U.S.-Canada area, 49 in the eastern area and 83 in the western area, and 22% of those have been observed. Because of concern over the catch of cod in particular at this point, we are preparing an action to require the use of haddock separator trawl in the eastern U.S.-Canada area. That should be available soon. And finally, Lalago squid. We closed the directed fishery for Lalago for quarter two on May 23rd, 2006, and the quarter three directed Lalago squid fishery will open on July 1. Thank you.
Any questions for George? Dave?
Yeah, George, I think you mentioned days at sea usage. Is there a report in the binder that describes that? I think there is, but I can't put my hands on it.
It wasn't days at sea usage. It was days at sea leased.
Sorry, days at sea leased, yes.
Yeah.
There's a report in the binder that would describe the days at sea leased that have occurred so far? No.
I don't think so, but I can give you those numbers if you want.
I thought I had seen...
I think we also have it on our website.
Yeah, maybe that's where I saw it, but it seems to me that days at sea leased has gone up rather dramatically. At least that's my view, dramatically, my term. And I just would encourage the service to pay close attention to that increased usage of days at sea, that is, leased days at sea, because I know from taking a closer look at the analysis that went into Framework 42 that the amount of days at sea leased has a very significant impact on such things as the differential days at sea counting. There's a direct relationship between amount of days at sea leased and what comes off the top. So please be wary of that particular analysis and the fact that the days at sea leased seems to be going up. For example, this is what I'm referencing. This is in groundfish number three. Thank you. Thank you, John. Preliminary day at sea use lease report. And I see that grand total 2004 day at sea leased, 6,248. In 2005, it's 8,129. And then what's even more significant, I think, is when you look at 2006, the month of May, for which we have data, 1,218 days at sea were leased. And that's a rather significant increase in days at sea leased relative to 2004 and 2005. This is going to have tremendous implications once we get to the next go-around for determining what TAC should be, differential days at sea counting. Because, as I said, this is factored into all of the analyses that are used to determine the price to be paid for increased days at sea leased or increased days at sea used. And this is definitely, well, I shouldn't say definitely, they're not used here, they're leased, but I'm going to assume that they will be used. So just a word of caution, I continue to be concerned about the increased numbers of days at sea leased that I assume will be used. And the implications will be grave, I suspect, next time we have to tweak the ground fish rules. But we might be looking at a 3-to-1 day at sea count for the inshore portion of the Gulf of Maine, or 4-to-1. I hope not, but that's the way it's beginning to look to me, just from this small amount of information that we have available at this time.
George, I just wanted to ask, you mentioned that you're anticipating an announcement out of the regional office regarding the use of the haddock separator trawl in the eastern area. I ask this question every time we talk about this, but that's for vessels using trawl gear, right? It's not going to be a requirement to only use the haddock separator trawl in the area. Is that the only gear that's going to be allowed?
I believe that's the way it's been drafted up to this point. There'll be a Federal Register document published. It won't just be an announcement.
Currently, hook and line and gillnet are allowed in the eastern area. So this action is going to not allow hook and line and gillnets into that area?
No, I believe it's for... I don't want to answer that at this point.
Okay,
it's still under development, and I'm not sure enough of how it's been drafted at this point to answer that.
Because in the past, I think at least in Framework 42, which hasn't been approved, and I thought in Framework 41 and maybe 40A, when this issue came up, it was for vessels using trawl gear, the haddock separator trawl. So it was specific to vessels using trawl gear. So could you look into that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Anybody else? George, I have a question. We were at the chairman's meeting. Bill Holgraf mentioned to us that there was a hold put on Framework 42. Do you know any status on that? Or?
No, I wasn't at the meeting, and I'm not sure what that means.
He mentioned that there was a hold put on by a senator saying that Framework 42 could not be implemented.
I don't know. I don't know what he was referring to. That would seem very unusual. Oh. I mean, for a senator to be able to take that kind of an action in a process that's already underway, I'd be very surprised if that would. There may have been some question asked OMB to look at the rule, but I can't imagine it would stop the process. I'm not aware that it has.
Okay. Built? Okay. Next. Gene?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank David Pierce's employer for suing us on the emergency rule. I was running out of things to do this summer. But the Commonwealth of Massachusetts sued the agency with respect to the emergency stopgap rule in groundfish. And they sued under two laws primarily, other than the Administrative Procedure Act. They claimed several violations of the Madison-Stevens Act. First, that the emergency rule should have considered a mixed stock exception and did not. The lawsuit alleges that we're in violation of National Standard 1 in promulgating this rule because it is not reasonably calculated to prevent overfishing for Gulf of Maine cod, Cape Cod, Gulf of Maine yellowtail, Southern New England Mid-Atlantic yellowtail and winter flounder, white hake and Georges Bank winter flounder, that it fails to achieve optimum yield for each of these species within the Northeast multi-species fishery, for those species that have been found to meet their fishing mortality reduction targets. Also, the suit also alleges that we failed to comply with National Standard 8 by not providing for sustained participation of Massachusetts fishing communities and that we did not minimize adverse impacts on such communities. And also, we were sued on National Standard 10 because the emergency fails to promote the safety of human life. The lawsuit also alleges we're in violation of NEPA on several grounds. First, that in the NEPA, or in the process of promulgating this emergency rule, we failed to adequately allow for the opportunity for those affected by the rule, particularly Massachusetts residents, to participate in the development of the rule, that the comment period was too short, that we failed to adequately examine the impacts on the various Massachusetts fishing communities, that an EIS and that an EIS should have been done instead of an EA for the emergency rule. And the lawsuit seeks to permanently stop the agency from enforcing the 1.4 to 1 differential days at sea counting regime. They seek a declaration that the emergency rule in implementing the differential counting regime is invalid under the Act. This was the primary focus of the lawsuit, by the way, is the differential counting regime, and that the rule violates NEPA. Now, we were also, we had sort of mixed blessing in terms of the appeal on Amendment 13 lawsuit brought by Oceana. Oceana had appealed the decision in that case with respect to compliance with NEPA and satisfactorily considering all alternatives for mitigating adverse impacts on essential fish habitat. We filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit for lack of jurisdiction on the grounds that the decision in that lawsuit was not final. You can't appeal to an appellate court until the decision is final. The basis for that argument is that the judge in the Amendment 13 lawsuit remanded to the agency the standard bycatch reporting methodology issues, meaning that while it was on remand, the opinion was not final until the remand was sent back to the court and the court could rule, or the remand was completed and the court could complete its findings with respect to compliance with the law. And the appellate court agreed with that argument. They dismissed the appeal for lack of jurisdiction at this time, with the understanding that the appellants, the Oceana, could refile an appeal once the remand was completed to challenge it. I think that's all I have, Mr. Chairman, at this time.
Questions of Gene? Okay. Next, Northeast Science Center. Doctor.
Thank you. I'd like to start out by reporting, giving you a survey update. The sea scallop dredge survey will commence on July the 10th. The AFMSC Northern Shrimp Survey will commence on July the 24th. The spring survey results have been released to the stock assessment biologists, and the resource survey report for the 2006 spring survey is in review and will be released by the end of June. The 2003 haddock year class is still prominent in the survey, but the fish are growing slowly. Currently, they're about 11 to 16 inches in length. And significant numbers of age zero cod, that's age zero, not one, age zero cod were found in the Gulf of Maine. These fish are very small, 1 to 2 inches, and indices for age zero fish are not reliable indicators of future recruitment. However, I'm just reporting that they have been observed. And the state of Massachusetts has also reported at least one large toe with age zero cod. The update for the Bigelow, the builders and mission trials were completed in the Gulf of Mexico in late May. The acoustic sound range test was conducted on June the 8th and 9th. The delivery date of the Bigelow to NOAA continues to be June the 23rd. The vessel will then transit to Norfolk, Virginia in early August and to New England in early September. The vessel will stage New England cruises out of the Newport Naval Shipyard in Newport, Rhode Island. And no permanent home for the Bigelow has been named at this time. In the fall of this coming year, fall of 2006, there will be science comparisons being done between the Albatross, which is our current vessel, and the Bigelow, the new vessel. And at the moment, it's on the Albatross, in terms of how long the Albatross will be online, that is uncertain at this time. But right now, we are planning on having it through the fall of 2007. Going on to stock assessment issues, we have just yesterday completed SARC 43 in Woods Hole with assessments of black sea bass, spiny dogfish, ocean quahog, and deep sea red crab. And the assessments were reviewed by the independent panel from the Center of Independent Experts, the CIE. We had three reviewers, and they are now writing their reports. We don't know what they're going to tell us about the acceptability of the assessments. And until we receive their reports, the documents and all the materials that were presented at that meeting remain unofficial and have no status whatsoever. So we're going to report to you at your next council meeting on the final official results from that meeting. The SARC that's coming up next fall will be SARC 44, and we have on that schedule Atlantic surf clam, skates, and hagfish. And as was mentioned at the start of the meeting, we had a long meeting to discuss the timing of the GARM 3. We had that meeting in Woods Hole, and it was attended by both councils, members of the NRCC, and many of the stock assessment biologists and people who do aging at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. And there was a airing out of the entire schedule and all the data needs that are required to go into the four meetings, actually, that compose GARM 3. And as Paul Howard mentioned, the result of that meeting was that it's very difficult for the Science Center to move its schedule up without taking the 2007 data out of the assessment. So at the moment, we are working under the assumption that the meeting will continue to be held the first week of August. And I know that in September, the council will be discussing options in terms of how it would like to proceed regarding its management. But at the center, we have many people to lots of planning to do in order to get all the data ready for the different meetings. And at the moment, we are continuing to operate under that assumption that the meeting will be the first week of August. Thank you. That concludes my report.
Thank you, Jim. I know you'll be briefing this council at the September meeting, but will information from the last assessment be available for the August meeting at the Mid-Atlantic for the black sea bass, dogfish, and...
Yes, it will.
Okay. So it's unofficial, it's anecdotal, and you can't comment, but there's good news on dogfish?
Well, I think that a lot of people know that the survey index for dogfish was up this year, and that may be good news to some people.
I couldn't resist. Dave?
Yeah, Jim, you mentioned the 2003 year class of haddock continues to grow slowly. Have you looked at any other species? Because anecdotally, I can tell you some of the fish we've tagged, which are cod and yellowtail, have also shown a slowdown in growth in 2004 and 2005. and the bottom water temperatures for the last 2 years have been extraordinarily cold, brought on by those two cold winters, compared to, say, 2002 and 2003. So I was just wondering if you've looked at all species or just haddock.
For this report, that was just information that I got from Russ Brown to relate to you. But we are planning to have someone from the center address the council and give a report at your next council meeting. After I give the report about the results of the SAW SARC, someone will speak, possibly Dave Mountain, to talk about how the environment has been changing recently and what factors might be relevant out there that could affect fish growth. So there will be that report coming at your September meeting. And I know that in a lot of the stock assessments that we looked at for GARM 2, there were a number of cases where I think the weighted age had declined recently. So we could go back to those reports to see evidence of that. But that's about all I know. Thanks.
At the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting next week on Tuesday, we have from 4 o'clock to 5:30 in the afternoon a joint dogfish committee, and it says on the agenda that they will review preliminary data updates for spiny dogfish. So in light of what was just said, what will be presented to that joint dogfish committee for consideration?
I'm not really sure. I was contacted by the staff of the Mid-Atlantic Council, and they said that that may have been written on the agenda by mistake, and that there won't be any official news. All the documents that were handed out at the SARC are unofficial, and people are welcome to look at those documents and review them for what they're worth. But I stressed this at the meeting, and I'm stressing it again, that those documents have no official status, and so people should not wave them around as though they're the bottom line. They may change, and in fact, assessments may or may not even be accepted. So we have to live with that reality.
Okay. In that case, I would assume that joint dogfish committee meeting can take place over the course of maybe 5 to 10 minutes. Since it's just a review of the NIMS final review for the 2006-2008 fishing years, and I think that's pretty short and sweet. So with that said, I will likely spend all my attention at the meeting from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock on squid, mackerel, and butterfish and not look forward to discussions on dogfish.
Paul?
We received a call from the Mid-Atlantic staff that basically said we do not encourage you to come to the meeting, that we were hasty in the agenda item. We will not be discussing dogfish at any detail. So I informed Frank, and Frank has sent out word to our dogfish committee that not encouraged to attend, and that if you do, it would be on your own dime because we don't have the funding to support it.
Okay. Phil? Oh, Jim, did you want to respond?
This is another point, so I can make this point later if you want to continue with questions.
Phil?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad to hear we're going to get this report because I had written up a motion actually to request that the Science Center give us a very detailed report along the age growth of all of the stocks. Because we know we've got a problem in haddock. I mean, we've got a problem right now where these fish are almost the same size they were a year ago. They actually are. I mean, they're damn close to the same size they were last year. There's a very big problem in the growth rate on these fish. We're seeing a growth rate problem in quite a few other stocks. The report we got was we're seeing it in mackerel. There's a report we're getting that we're seeing it in herring. We're seeing it in quite a few different stocks, and I think it'd be imperative that this council be aware of that, and that we need a very detailed report on the growth rate across the range on this. So hopefully this report that's coming, if not, I don't know if we need to make a motion that we have a very detailed report covering it, or whether that just is in the plan and of what's already coming. I'm a little unclear on that.
Yeah, Phil, this is a little different than what we had in mind. I think we could try to accommodate this request, but in general, when the idea came up to have someone report to you, we were talking more in general terms and hadn't focused on that particular issue. And if that is something that you really want to know about, then it would be good to let us know well ahead of time so that we can have someone try to summarize those data for you and try to make it available at that report. Also, the person who will be speaking on oceanography and water temperature and so forth might not be the same person who's qualified to tell you about biology. So it might be that we'll need to have two people or something like that. So let your wishes be known. I think perhaps something in writing about that would be useful.
In that case, Mr. Chairman, I move that the Science Center provide a council at the September meeting with a very detailed report on the status of the 2003 year class growth rates and all other affected stocks. And that's open for tweaking there.
So I'll wait till we get that up before I ask for a second. Okay, is that right, Phil?
Yeah, like I said, I wrote it on the fly, so it could be tweaked a little bit, if council wishes.
Okay. Is there a second? Seconded by Jimmy Odlin. Okay, I think we all should be a limited discussion. Any discussion? Dave?
Yeah, assume, Phil, you want to know whether the growth rates are the result of carrying capacity or bottom water temperature or some combination, as best as can be determined. That's what you're really asking, right?
Yeah, we need to know, one, if there's a problem across the board, how big this problem actually is. Is it a problem? Them kind of questions, and what could be causing it. To me, it's a great big question that you end up with a lot of dilemma on. I mean, I don't want it done with a brushstroke saying this is what it's looking like out there. I think we need some answers, especially going forward with the adjustments and the GOM coming up. We need to know what's going on, or what they do know at this point, at any rate.
Okay. Times like this, I think I miss Eric Smith, but where it says a more detailed report, I'm not sure what the more is. I think you need the detail because it's more detailed than what?
Yeah.
So, if we take the more out. So, Mark just sat down where Eric used to sit, so he can be the wordsmith for us. Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. All those in favor, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. Two abstentions. Okay, motion carries. Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mid-Atlantic's got the same concerns and has raised them before, so I'm reasonably sure we can come up with a letter that matches this and include a list of species that we have concerns for. We'll do that next week, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Jim, you had another?
Yeah, I'm regarding the letter that's in the briefing materials that was written by yourself. It's number 6. There's one date in there that I think you meant to say 2007 instead of 2008. It's in the third paragraph. It's about the 6th line down. And it says, without losing calendar year 2008. In fact, if the survey, if we have to do the GARM in early spring, we'd be losing the calendar year 2007 data because the year would not be complete. I think that 2008 there needs to be corrected to 2007. That would be consistent with what Paul Howard was saying earlier.
Thanks for catching. That is a mistake. It should say 2007. Okay, any else for the Science Center? Hearing none, move along to liaisons. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mid-Atlantic Council met Virginia Beach on May 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Behind tab 9 is the council report. I didn't write my own. I'm just going to read them one out. Included in that is the motion list and the FMAC recommendations. Day one consisted of 4 committee meetings, the SBRM, research set aside, protected resources, and the squid mackerel butterfish. That ate up the whole day. First half of day two consisted of 3 other committee meetings, search clam and tilefish, Magnus and Stevenson, and the ecosystem. Council went into session after lunch, and the tilefish quota setting was the afternoon topic. It's pretty detailed in the council report, so I'm not going to go into it, but they just reset the quota, and there was an issue on the dress weight and landed weight of the fish, which was resolved. But on squid, mackerel, butterfish for the next day, what I believe is of great importance to this council was the FMAP recommendation paper that's included in the binder. The reason I bring this up is if you look at this report recommendations, when you get down to it, there's a very big problem that I think puts the councils in a very problem. The reason I bring this up is this is the first FMAC product that I'm aware of. I think there's one in SPRM, but as far as an FMP, this is the first product of the FMAC that I know of, that I'm aware of, anyhow. When you get into the report, if you look, all of the recommendations on this FMAC is to use 3-inch mesh size in the squid fishery. That's unrealistic. I mean, anybody in the industry is going to tell you 3 inches is just unrealistic in the squid fishery. It's like fishing for shrimp with 3-inch mesh. It's not going to work. Yet every recommendation from this committee, from this paper, is for 3-inch mesh. Now, it was resolved somewhat at the meeting, but in my eyes, the reason I bring this up is it puts us in a bad position. We got a recommendation from this team that my understanding of this team is to try and make this process simpler. Yet we get a paper that comes out with recommendations for this mesh size that puts the council in a position of having to basically go against it. And in my eyes, that kind of puts us in a bad spot. The reason this came out, I feel, was the makeup of the FMAT team. Nobody on that team, there was no real world view of it. You know, I mean, they just signed a few science center people and a few staff and this council, I mean, the Nero people. Nobody was there to tell them that won't work. This just doesn't happen. So I think we really need to take a look at how the FMAT team is made up so that we don't get hit with a paper that says this is what we recommend and you'd be put in a position where you can't accept it. I think that's a problem. The efficiency is another issue. I mean, like I said, this was made to help us. It was supposed to administratively help us with the process. And the FACE report basically puts us in a hampering situation. So the reason I bring it up, like I said, is I think we really need to take a look at it. It's the FACE product, and we need to tweak this a little bit better so that we can get caught with it. That was about it for the Mid-Atlantic meeting. There'll be a meeting again next week in Wilmington. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Paul? Just a little follow-up on the FMAT situation. That's something that NIMS is encouraging or promoting under the Regulatory Streamlining Initiative. And our council and our staff is very critical and reluctant to buy into the FMAT because we feel it's an additional layer. We feel that the PDT should be the center of the universe, so to speak, with development and analyzing. And however, it is a national initiative for streamlining, and there are some benefits to an early meeting of an FMAT with the government, with NIMS, to highlight what the issues are going to be. Implementation issues, are there ESA issues, what are the issues? And that basically, the way I look at it, is we've agreed on a tentative basis, on a pilot project, to look at the FMATs, and they're working on a, we've got a couple working now. But basically, it's to identify issues and not make recommendations. And I'd be very concerned if our FMAT would make recommendations. Just, that's policy. That's council, staff, PDTs. So I know we have PDTs, the MID doesn't. So maybe there's a little bit of gray area between an FMAT and a PDT for the MID. But, you know, I'm hoping you'll never see a recommendation for policy or measures out of our FMAT. It's strictly process. How can we streamline things?
Okay. George?
Yeah, as Paul pointed out, the way that this council is using FMATs and the way the Mid-Atlantic is using FMATs is quite different. And that's primarily because of the fact that you're used to using PDTs and wanted to continue that process. So in your case, the FMATs are primarily scheduling issues, identification, and so forth. Mid-Atlantic is using them more as if they were PDTs. But I think there's part of the problem has been that this is a new process and not everybody is fully understanding of perhaps how the process should go. But I think there's also a misunderstanding that anything that comes out of an FMAT is somehow has to be accepted by the council. It does not. And any more than it comes out of a PDT or an AP or a monitoring committee. Before it can go anywhere, it has to be justified and discussed and analyzed and so forth to make sure that whatever the measure might be meets all the national standards and so forth. So I think you're getting overly excited about what you saw at that FMAT, partly because it's new and partly because I think that there's a misunderstanding that somehow the council's obligated to take a recommendation that comes out of that committee. It's not.
Dave?
Yeah, with the Phil, what document are you referencing? The FMAT recommendation. Is that in our binder?
No, it's
OK. could be on tab 9. Okay, fine. I'll take a look at that. I did have a couple of questions, but George has already addressed them, so I need not ask them. However, I will point out that even though, you know, we're not obliged to accept, you know, to adopt plan development team recommendations, once those recommendations are made, they have a tremendous amount of weight. And certainly the National Marine Fisheries Service gives them that weight, as they should. It'll be interesting to see how the FMAP process does work in the Mid-Atlantic, and I'll get a taste of that, I suppose, through my involvement with the Mackerel Committee.
Okay, Phil?
That's sort of the reason I asked it for it to be included. I understood George's point at the meeting. He made it very clear that we're not obligated to it, but once you put a piece of paper in a binder, it carries weight. You know, it puts us in the wrong place when we have to turn something like that down. And that's, I just want to put it on the table. And like, I realize there's a difference in the way we do it and the way they do it, but having it in front of you, having it brought forward in that manner, puts us in a bad place, in my view.
Jim? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that this is an issue that that needs to be aired. And George did a great job explaining down there that the council does not have to take an action, doesn't have to accept the recommendation. The fact is that recommendation coming from an FMAT or a monitoring committee or a PDT has implications. And the council has to have a way to not utilize it. They've got to argue against it, and they've got to make a very good case in order to do that. And, again, this is a new process. We understand that. But what it lacks in the Mid-Atlantic side is what you have incorporated, you, New England, have incorporated in your PDTs, and that is an industry member. The whole reason that there's a discussion about this FMAT is simply because there was an inclusion for 3-inch recommendation for the escapement of butterfish in the Lalago fishery. There lies the problem. There lies the problem. There's 60 to 70% of the Lalago fishery that never sees a butterfish. Yet nobody at that table made that statement. So what about the rest of the fishery that doesn't have this problem? Had you had one industry person sitting at that table, then the goal of the FMAT to expedite this process could be accomplished. The fact is it was dumped in our lap, and we had to make what I call significant statements to counter this inclusion of this 3-inch. You know, that was the whole ballgame, because like Philly said, it does carry some weight. And we're under a microscope for not using best scientific recommendations. It's only a suggestion, and we have to create a process or use the process to defend it. But this was a perfect example of what can go wrong with the wrong makeup. So I have very big concerns with the FMAT process at this point, the makeup of the FMAT process, and hope that there'll be some considerations. But you have accomplished it through your PDTs. And again, I think George explained that your PDT and our FMAT are somewhat similar. Our monitoring committee and your PDT, in my opinion, are not similar. So there's some problems there, but I think this is something you all want to keep an eye on. I don't disagree that the process may be useful in the future for FMATs, but you want to make darn sure that you've got good makeup and representation from all entities, and then it can work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any else for liaisons? Okay, moving along. Coast Guard, Jim.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Since the last report, there were 32 casualty cases. One death was reported offshore when the pot shifted on a lobster boat. One vessel sank and two ran aground. One collision reported due to pilot error, and there were 18 equipment casualties, including two fires. Three vessels were terminated due to lack of safety gear. Our boarding rates remain about the same, and our compliance rate is 87%. There were 3 closed area violations since the last report. I also have 3 updates from the last meeting. As far as AIS, we were told by headquarters that the proposal is back out for public comment and that there is no date when it will be implemented. As far as the observer program, we have stepped up our fishing vessel safety inspections. We've inspected over 254% more than we usually did at the same period to get fishing vessels in compliance with the sticker in case they were picked for the observer program. And so far, that appears to be working. We have a good partnership. Even vessels who fail the safety inspection once, we're able to reinspect them fairly quickly as soon as they get their discrepancies taken care of. And we've had no incidents where a vessel has been selected for the observer program but didn't have a sticker that they've had to get underway. We've either been able to get down to the boat and inspect the boat or work with them on it in some kind of timely manner. So, but we're still watching that. But right now, we just need to make sure that the fishermen know that they still need to get that safety inspection sticker before they get selected for the observer program. And the last thing is the latest issue of Commercial Fisheries News has an excellent article on the standardizing net measuring protocols, and it publishes verbatim our Coast Guard procedures on how we do net measuring, which is exactly what we wanted. We want to make it transparent. We want to make it consistent to everyone that. So we encourage any other articles like that that gets into that kind of detail. And that's all I have, sir.
Any questions? Any questions for Coast Guard?
Thank you, Jim. On just one question, Jim, on the well, a couple maybe. On the AIS thing, going back out for comment, has there been, I haven't been able to keep up with that, but has there been changes to it that it's now under, or is it going out?
A lot of it came of the meeting that we had up in Maine when we had that meeting, and there was enough discussion there that the Coast Guard went back with NOAA and said that we need to really talk about it, whether we're duplicating with VMS and AIS. And with this district commander, his opinion is that we don't need to do a duplication of the systems. So because a direct result of that, it went back. They didn't think the public comment was long enough, so they're putting it back out in the street. And what was supposed to come out in October now is being pushed off, but they don't have a direct date on it yet. But this is where we encourage people to get involved in the public comment.
I appreciate that. We'll be looking for that. And as far as the safety sticker, from what I hear down this end, it's ran fairly well. There has been a couple of problems, just a few, but it was basically not somebody that didn't have it, somebody that had one that ran out, and the inspectors, just backed up too hard to get it. And when you get an overlap with an observer, he only has X amount of days before you have to reassign and reapply.
Right.
So it's cost a couple of guys a couple of days here.
Okay.
But it's going on fairly well. So appreciate that, thank you.
Yes, I was just curious, do you have some idea or percentage of people that are now have current stickers? I mean, in other words, where are we, how far have we come, and how far do we still have to go?
If you look at just the raw numbers, it looks brutal, because there's so many permits out, it's hard to determine which vessels are actively fishing. So we're really just taking as the fishermen who know that they're actively fishing are calling up. If there is a small period where there's a lapse, depending on what that equipment is, we can work with them on that. But if you fail it, we come back. We try to come back and put you at the top of the list so that you can get reinspected so you can enter it away, as opposed to saying once you're inspected once, you go to the bottom of the list. It'll take months. But certainly certain ports, New Bedford is a really high percentage, but we don't have a good visibility up in Maine of who actually needs it. So the good thing is, there's only the observer program is, I don't know exactly how many observers there are, but it's not as big as we thought it was going to be. So the demand isn't there, but is that if the fishermen know they need it and they keep pushing the Coast Guard, we'll get out there and we will inspect it.
So what you're saying is, in terms of percentage inspected versus number of permits, the numbers are still low, but you don't know how many of those permits are actually active permits, so you have no real way of gauging what the real percentage of active boats is.
That's exactly right. If you look at all the permits, it looks terrible. It looks like we'd never be able to do it. We'd have to do like 40 a day to get everybody inspected. But what we find is the vessels that are actively fishing are making the effort to come up and step up, saying we need it right away, and we're able to get to them. So it really they have to call us to get there. So I'll try to get better numbers for you, but we knew that was a problem going in.
I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder when you said the observer program's not as big. Thankfully, it's not as big as you thought it would be. Come on up.
Is it okay to ask questions?
Yes. Come up to the microphone. No, you've got to come to the microphone, though. That's all.
And identify
yourself.
Thank you. Caroline Karp. I teach at Brown University, and I've been watching Rhode Island fisheries for a long time. And I have a question about the data you presented. It may follow this last question. You said compliance is 87%, and that number doesn't mean very much unless you say what it is you're monitoring and it's compliance with what. And so could you break that down a little bit?
Well, that number is really the report, what we do in the Coast Guard. That is our number. That is a report card back to headquarters about all the vessels that are out there and going by historical standards, where we are when we board them, what the compliance rate has been. So what headquarters wants us to have is a 92% compliance rate. Now, I can give you all the details and offline in that. What we're using as a measuring, what it really shows is that there's more violations out there. As it went from 92 to 87, it's more like a gauge. It just shows that there's more violations, there's more serious violations of closed area incursions, net mesh. So what headquarters is telling us is that the fishing vessels are seen to have more infractions offshore, so we need to have more resources. So it's a resource-based number for the Coast Guard as opposed to a report card on the fishing industry, if that makes sense.
Okay. But if I understand correctly, you said the number of vessels you actually inspect is very low, and you also don't know how many vessels are fishing at any given time. But if you were to estimate population of fishing vessels, what percent of them are you estimating are in violation of fisheries laws?
Oh, two separate things.
Okay.
The fishing vessel safety sticker we were talking about.
Yeah.
If you look at all the permits that are out there, and you look at the number of fishing vessel safety stickers that are out there right now, there's a huge disparity. There are many more vessels need to be inspected because it's a voluntary program, so it's not mandatory.
Okay, so that aside.
That's aside. As far as the fishing vessels that are out there that we're boarding, as far as percentages, is that what you're talking
yes.
about? Yes. That number, that 92%, is something that they do Coast Guard-wide. So I can give you the stats and figures on that. But that's something that is only used to get resources for the Coast Guard. In other words, when I say resources, meaning our medium endurance cutters that come up here from Virginia, if the compliance rate goes lower, we're able to get more resources here. A 270-foot cutter that would normally go on a drug patrol off Columbia, we're able to go to our operational commander and saying, there's more violations up here. We need to have more assets up here. So we may get two medium endurance cutters up here. So the report to the council is just a barometer of activity for Coast Guard vessels because we're multi-mission.
So there's sort of this perverse situation where, in fact, you do better the worse the compliance. Worse compliance, better off you are in terms of seeking resources.
The better the higher the compliance, it looks like we have more coverage.
Yeah, but in a way, if the compliance is lower, you can say we don't have enough people, and so that's your. But you see, from the public's perspective, which I'm asking about here. You're the sort of front line in terms of saying how well is are the fishers themselves, in fact, complying with the law. And so
right. You
gather those data. And what's your sense? What's the number in terms of compliance with fisheries laws meant to protect fisheries?
Okay. I do have that. For instance, in total violations for 2006, if you look at that, we have almost 700 violations in the last year. The year before was 800. The year before was 700. So it's about the same. That's all violations. That's safety, fisheries.
And would you, what percent of the vessels that are operating do you estimate you actually inspect?
That number I don't have. I could try to find that for you. That's hard to say for just fisheries.
Is it less than 10%, or is it?
No, I'd say it
if
depends.
If I can interject here for a minute, I mean, you're kind of putting him on the spot right now, and that's not the information he's prepared to give. So I'm sure.
That's central, though, to the committee, right?
That's
the kind of information that council looks at from time to time?
Yeah, the violations of that. But I'm sure Jim will be able to get you if you ask him and put it in writing, he'll be able to get you the information you need, but he doesn't have all that at his fingertips right now.
Okay, I'll look for you
later.
Yeah,
I'll be glad to give you one. It's a little inside baseball, but I'd be glad to give you the breakdown. It's all public information.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
He'll be here for the duration of the meeting. So, okay. Anybody else? Okay. Moving on to NIMS enforcement. Andy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. In this reporting period, we the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement, has made approximately $220,000 worth of fishery seizures, and the Office of General Counsel has assessed NOVAs in the amount of about $2,076,000. I will start off with the observer safety decal issue because that's where the captain left off. Just to kind of confuse the issue, we have some different estimates, vastly different estimates than the captain cited. However, I don't know where my information came from, so I'll just throw it out there and we can do follow up if you'd like. We estimate that there are currently about 20 vessels currently eligible to fish who do not have safety decals, which seems to be far better than we anticipated. So the information that I have doesn't seem as bleak as the information the Coast Guard provided. If you'd like, we'll do some follow-up and find out where the truth is. However, bottom line is that we have been told that if a vessel currently calls the Coast Guard Inspection Office for the inspection, it's about a four-day turnaround. So there again, we're not faced with the crisis that we feared. And so far we've identified two violations of vessels that attempted to fish without the safety decal. Those two violations are being referred to General Counsel for consideration of prosecution. I think that two violations out of all the potential violations is a pretty good result. We're comfortable with that level of compliance. Recently, we did another border operation up in Calais, Maine, enforcing regulations pertaining to lobster imports from Canada. And we seized 191 undersized lobsters that came in from a Canadian dealer, and that resulted in in summary settlements of about $8,500. We'll continue to do those operations occasionally, and we're doing them in conjunction with Canadian DFO. So it's a good synergy. Both agencies are getting more bang for the buck than we would if we went at it alone. The herring emergency rule expired on the 6th of June, bringing us back to zero tolerance for bycatch. We are monitoring herring offloads as best we can. When I say as best we can, the dilemma is that these offloads take about 12 hours, and you really have to observe it from start to finish in order to be effective. However, we're seeing herring boats coming in with no bycatch whatsoever. So maybe it's the luck of the draw, maybe it's different kind of fishing habits, but we're seeing a good level of compliance. If we continue with the zero tolerance for bycatch, real consistent enforcement is going to be problematic. But we will keep an eye, we'll do spot checks, and if we get intelligence or a tip that there's a problem, we'll certainly try to be there, or we will have our state partners be there representing us. Again, we do not seem to be in a crisis mode as we were 2 years ago, although it's early in the season. I have a little update on the VMS reimbursement plan. The funds have been transferred to the Pacific States Commission, who will be dispersing them. I don't believe that the Federal Register notice has been published yet, but that will give everyone specific instructions on how to apply for the reimbursement. That process is on track. We have not fallen behind the target dates on that. In the world of VMS, we currently have 1,362 vessels in the Northeast that we are monitoring. It's pretty much an even split between Boattrax and SkyMate, with Boattrax having about 648 boats, SkyMate 675 boats, and we have a new approved vendor, Tron and Tron. Currently, there are three vessels using Tron units. The Tron costs about $3,600 for the installation, and then there are monthly fees of about $45. As you're probably aware, the protocol call-in system for days at sea counting is now completely done with, and we have gone to an interactive voice response system. For the first month or so, we had all of the growing pains that we feared we had have, and we had breakdowns and crashes, but in the last 2 weeks, the IVR is working pretty well. We do have a backup phone number, and we do have a help desk. If any of your contacts have suggestions or problems with the IVR, we'd like to hear about that. It's still a new system. It's going to be a great system. It's saving us a bundle of money, and it's more efficient for the fishers, and it's going to get better. But we're open to suggestions if anybody has any. Recently, I drafted a permit holder letter that's now making its way around the Gloucester office at a painfully slow rate regarding the net mesh policies, how nets are measured, how we use spades and weights, and what people can expect. It's an outreach effort just to keep everybody informed of what we're doing and what we're not doing, because there's so much controversy and misinformation about that. That net mesh, that permit holder letter will supplement the article that Jim referenced earlier. The NOAA Office of Law Enforcement at headquarters is going to provide the New England Council with $16,000 this year for law enforcement committee meetings. I believe that's a pretty quick turnaround. It will be happening very soon, and that will help with the funding issues that the chairman mentioned earlier. Finally, looking into my law enforcement crystal ball, I see a crisis looming in the future. And I think I mentioned this to you folks before. I think we're going to have some real issues with aquaculture products and farmed fish being mislabeled, commingled, and used to launder illegally taken fisheries products. Three separate and distinct issues, three very serious issues that I think will be detrimental to the fishing industry and to the American consumer. We're doing as much as we can currently to bone up on aquaculture law enforcement issues and to be proactive. However, it's difficult because it's a new challenge, and it's something that we're taking on in addition to everything else. If you folks in the industry see a training opportunity for law enforcement, a meeting, a conference, or something that will help us learn about the aquaculture business, we would like to be involved in that so we can kind of get into the heads of the minority of bad guys who are going to exploit that for their own good and nobody else's. As you probably know, right now we're working a huge nationwide aquaculture case that involves imports from Vietnam of catfish that was being marketed as a whole host of things, snapper, grouper, sole, and you know, we're talking 17 cents pound illegally imported catfish being sold at a premium. As an aside, it was being laundered through another country to avoid import taxes and duties. So it's occurring already. I think it's going to be a real wave of the future. So if you can give us a hand on getting ahead of it, that would be great. That concludes my report, and I'll take questions.
Any questions, Randy? What's up, Dave?
I actually got three. On the VMS, we all received a letter that was, you know, kind of worded, you will need a VMS in the future for groundfish with no date on it. Do you have a sense of how many boats in the groundfish fleet currently have VMS? And because there is no date, a lot of people just don't have this sense of urgency that they've got to get one, and the waiting list is already pretty long. I mean, I'm scheduled to get one the end of June, and I, you know, I called in May.
I don't have that information with me, but I'll find out and give you a call.
Okay, I just want to make sure we're not going to run into a head-on crash here when all of a sudden 42 is approved on a certain date and less than, you know, half the fleet probably has VMS.
Well, I can't answer your question specifically. I can tell you that we're working with the vendors and we're giving them as much heads up for future demand as we can with all three vendors, and we're doing our best to avoid any kind of a last-minute crunch. But I'll get the specific information to you, Dave.
Thank you. The second question was from a fisherman in my harbor. He has a scarlet, general category scarlet VMS, and he's a groundfish boat. And he believes he's being pulled. He's paying for twice the poling, even though he's not scalloping, and he wanted to know if anything could be done about that.
You yes, know, if you
could
give
declare
me,
out of scalloping and just be pulled at half the rate.
If you give me the specific information, I'll look into it. And if a correction needs to be made, we'll take care of it.
I don't think it's – I think it's a fleet-wide correction. It's not an individual. I think it's anybody who has a scallop – general category scallop VMS is pulled at the general category scallop VMS rate, which I believe is twice what groundfish is.
I'll have that information by the break for you.
Okay. And my last one concerns the cod hail, a call-in. At least in my harbor, there's massive confusion about what to do if you have 2 days' worth of cod. To me, it seems pretty clear, but, the fishermen who aren't on VMS have to call in when they land and report that they have more than a day's worth. The VMS people have to declare some kind of a code, but a lot of the VMS people feel that they don't have to declare because they have been out more than a day and they have more than a day's worth of cod, so where's the problem? When in reality, what you're counting is the differential time for that extra amount of cod. So I would suggest that compliance with the cod reporting, at least in my area, is at levels approaching zero at this point because people simply don't understand what they're supposed to do.
Okay. We'll make some clarifications on that. And I'll have to read the reg before I can comment on it, but we'll get the word out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Andy. Just one quick question on the spade issue for the twine measuring. I haven't really read that article yet, to be honest, but where are we on the chances of adopting the change in the weight?
Well, that was put back to the council. Our position in law enforcement is that the council chooses to increase the weight, we can still enforce it. Whether or not it's increased is not really an enforcement issue. I would only ask that you keep in mind that an increase in weight is a de facto increase in mesh size. The only clarification that we made was that we're not going to shake the net because that became very subjective. So the procedures are pretty simple. Basically, we put the net in, the mesh in the net. We take the standard series of measurements, and we go from there. If the weight changes, the protocol won't change, and the enforceability won't change. So we're okay with that.
Thanks, Andy. I want to follow up on Dave Gaethel's line of questioning concerning the VMS requirements for both groundfish, multi-species VMS vessels, and general category BMS requirements. Is there a practical reason why the rate of pinging on a vessel that holds both permits needs to increase beyond what one of the plans calls for, once per hour? Is it a technical reason?
There is no, as far as I'm aware, there's no reason. So let me look into that. I know that in certain cases we increase pinging, like when people are near closed areas. And I know that when we suspect a violation, we can manually increase pinging, but that's not a fleet-wide issue.
Right.
So if there is a technical reason or a practical reason, I will find out and report back.
Thank you.
And in eastern Georgia's area, it's been closed for about 8 months, and some boats just recently went out there and as it opened in May. And they reported horrendous catches of lost or abandoned or cut off lobster traps. And I'm talking 50, 100 traps in a tow with the heads cut out of them. So something was going on out there, and it brings up another issue. What are these guys supposed to do with their those traps? They can't bring them in, and they can't dump them.
I can't comment on the specifics, but we're aware of that event, and we're looking into it, the event that occurred out there. As far as removal of the traps, I believe you're correct. I don't think that they can lawfully be removed by anyone but the owner, correct? And if that is the case, I don't have a solution except for the council to permit certain exceptions. Obviously, NOAA does not have the resources to go out and clean up the trash. I imagine that the states and the Coast Guard are in the same boat, if you will. Perhaps there ought to be some mechanism for the industry to take care of that.
Yeah, just to follow up, and my understanding is they can't bring the traps in because if somebody finds a trap on one of those boats, they could be accused of molesting traps. The other issue is they can't dump them back overboard because it's illegal to dump plastic. So we've got fishermen in they can't do it. They can't do anything right.
Yeah, that's a good assessment of it. I can tell you that nobody is going to be prosecuted by my office for any reasonable action. However, I've got to go on the record and say that I do not have the authority to condone anybody doing anything contrary to the regulations. So right now it's a catch-22. I imagine that legally an exception can be made. But it would have to be properly done.
Okay. The one thing that might help if there's, if there's a cutter out there, you can call the Coast Guard, and then we could work with NOAA on something like that. But we could talk offline on that and come up with a solution.
Okay. Anybody else? Yep. The audience? Yep. Well.
Just sit next to you since my question is for you. My name is Caroline Karp again, and again from Brown. And my question has to do with this derelict gear issue. And NOAA, in fact, is really active in the issue of derelict gear. And the states have been active in the issue of derelict gear as well. And it seems to me one possibility for the council to consider would be requiring everybody with gear to post what would be called a performance bond as a condition of fishing, so that if the gear stays out there in the ocean, whether it's the Coast Guard or NOAA or somebody else, one of these other boats brings in the gear, they can draw on this particular bond, on this capital fund, in order to be reimbursed for the cost of cleaning it up. But then the real cost of disposal or loss, whether it's accidental or deliberate, goes to the person who owns the gear. Because there is a lot of effort right now on derelict gear, both at the federal level and the state level. It would be nice to see the council pursue some of that. And performance bonding would work.
Thank you. That's a good suggestion. Some we need to remember that some of this gear, perhaps a majority of it, and certainly the gear that was referenced here, was abandoned as a result of vandalism. And it would be perceived as unfair if the owner of the gear, the victim of one crime, would then have to pay for the cleanup. However, we need to find a way to encourage the community to take care of itself, and you know, that's part of being a good neighbor and community-oriented policing. And the gear just can't stay out there, so we're going to have to find a solution.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I have a quick follow-up on the state of Maine's ghost gear policy. And the Marine Patrol is very receptive to getting a telephone call or a radio call from anybody who locates lost gear and permits them at the time to bring it ashore. It's not a big deal, and they don't make it a big deal.
Okay, thank you. Harriet?
I'm just listening to the line of questioning, and I believe if it hasn't changed, lobster people, when they lose gear, they can petition to get their money back. But I think the issue that's trying to be made is a vessel's out there fishing. He picks up floating traps. What is he going to do? And I think it's a serious thing, I think, that has to be settled. I don't think it's anything to do with neighbor, being a good neighbor. It's got to do with picking up trash in the ocean, and you can't keep it on your boat. You can't throw it overboard. Has to be a solution here. We're fishing. There has to be something done, and it has to be done more or less quickly. I think that's what you're trying to get at, isn't it, Mr. Odlin and everybody else here? Yeah, it is an issue. I think I remember when I don't see him here from New Bedford, our representative brought it up before, too. There's a lot of gear that floats around out there, lobster traps. Why they're floating, that's another issue. The point is, your boat picks it up. Now what do they do? They're a victim of circumstances. So I think it's an important issue because there's regulations. I think mostly came up from the West Coast on touching other people's gear, more in crab traps. Been applied here on East Coast issues, but it is an issue that needs attention. It's got to be cleared up. We can't just, what's the vessel to do? If we can't get instruction here or in the regulations, we can't interpret what isn't on paper. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you, Andy.
Oh, Paul?
If the council would like, if this is a serious problem, then, you know, if you direct me to write a letter to NIMS, they manage lobsters in the EEZ, to have them, you know, take a look at it and to come up with a solution to the problem. So if you don't have any objection, I'll just send a letter to them because they manage the lobster. We can't do anything in our rigs. It'd have to be NIMS.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you, Andy. So, well, is there any objection to Paul writing the letter? Okay. All right, we'll get that done. Next is, thank you, Andy. Atlantic States, is there anybody here for anybody at the last meeting? Anybody want to? Okay. Okay, we move on to standardized bycatch. Dana, are we ready to go, or do you need some time?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're ready.
Yeah. Well, I'm being asked to take a break here, so I'll take a 10-minute break. Sorry, Dana.
Get back here. Dana,
I'd
like to turn over to you.
Oh, try that again. We're back in session here. Dana, it's all yours.